Wild courage exists to galvanize a generation of men. The tools and courage to fight for what matters most. And tell the stories that are born in the redemption of lives and souls.
Hey guys, before we jump into the next story, I wanted to let you know that we are excited to announce our spring retreat, which is going to be April 26th through the 28th in Garden Valley, Idaho, which is about an hour and 15 minutes north of the Boise Airport. It's up in the mountains. It's a beautiful spot. We're only taking 30 spots, and so we like to keep these pretty intimate and small. So if that's something that interests you, if you want to go to our website, which just our new website just launched today, we're super excited about, check that out at thewildcourage.life. And there you can find more info about the fires that are happening all around the country and about our retreats that we have, one in the spring and one in the fall, and kind of what's going on with Wild Courage and different ways you could partner with us. That'd be great. Go check that out. This retreat's going to be focused on grief. And if that's something that you don't think maybe is applicable to you, I would encourage you to go back to the conversation I had with Seth Dahl a few weeks ago that's out on the podcast and listen to that. It was a very insightful conversation about grief and unprocessed grief and pain and how it shows up in our lives still. Also, I've been trying to record the video of these conversations more. I don't know a lot of people know that, so if you want to go check that out and subscribe to our YouTube channel, you can find us on there. Also, you know, we have a Facebook and Instagram page. And lastly, if you could, however you listen to this podcast, go down and leave a comment or rate us. They tell me that helps with the algorithm so that when people are searching for new podcasts, the more traction we get there, the better it helps get the message out. Which again, if you find any of these stories resonate or are helpful to you in your journey of figuring this crazy, messy, beautiful life out, we would appreciate it if you could do that. And also just share it with somebody that maybe you think somebody's story will resonate with and give them hope and encouragement to know that they're not alone in whatever heartache they're going through, and to give hope, which again is the point of Wild Courage and all that we're up to. So I really appreciate it. Thanks, guys. Adios. Hey guys, welcome back or to the Wild Courage podcast. Today I am in Elko, Nevada at the, where are we at? What's this? The Stockman's. The famous Stockman's with my new friend. We've kind of been friends for a little while loosely, but we just got to meet today, Matt Robertson.
Yeah. How's it going, Jeremy?
Man, thanks for jumping on here.
Yeah. So, thanks for having me.
You've been pretty busy up here in Elko at the cowboy poetry deal, singing some of your songs, huh?
Yeah, I just got done with my last show here at 3 o'clock, and first one was on Thursday. I was able to be on the big stage with some legends, Waddy Mitchell.
Dang.
And Henry Reelbird, Ned Ledoux, and me did a show, and it was, you know, just super cool for me. I'm sure those guys are whatever, but I mean, I felt like a rock star. And
so do you like get to hang with them before and stuff?
Yeah, go back in the green room and just kind of lounge around and visit a little bit, and it's pretty cool.
That's freaking amazing, dude.
Yeah,
because I mean, you're just like writing these songs at home, right? And then did you ever dream that someday you'd be like getting to sit along next to some of these guys and singing on the same stage with them?
No, I mean, that's the cool thing. And I mean, I mentioned it on my set there, you know, my mom and dad had a saddle shop, and my brother and I would hang out in there and listen to Waddy Mitchell and Don Edwards tapes. And, you know, and then like Henry Reelbird, he announced the Indian relay races and at the Sheridan Wyo Rodeo. And I remember listening to him and him telling jokes and doing his thing. And of course, Ned Ledoux, I mean, it was the first time I met Ned. I knew all of his siblings before that. I used to live in KC for a little while and had met Chris. But I mean, it was just kind of, you know, full circle. It's pretty cool to get to be in the same place as those guys and do your thing. And in a way, they've all inspired me to be sure where I'm at. So it's just, yeah, surreal.
So I don't even know. Are you from Wyoming?
Yeah, I grew up in Wheatland, Wyoming.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
And your folks had a saddle shop?
Yeah, I mean, for a few years, they had a saddle shop in Wheatland. And I mean, we kind of moved around a lot. And we always, well, for the most time that we were in Wheatland, we moved around a lot. And my mom and dad had a place, eventually had a place out east of town that they owned. And during that time, they opened a saddle shop in town and fixed boots. And my dad started building saddles and doing leather goods and stuff like that for a few years. So
did you go like to graduate from high school in Wheatland? Like you kind of lived in that same area all the, yeah, the whole time.
Yeah. I think, I don't even know how old I was when we moved there. I was born in, we lived in Big Piney when I was born. I was born in Rock Springs and then, went to Torrington. My dad was a brand inspector. And then I think maybe when I was like 3 or 4, we moved to Wheatland. And that's
where, better than Rock Springs.
Yeah.
Sorry to all my Rock Springs. I shouldn't have said that because there's a lot of people that listen to this from Rock Springs.
Yeah.
I love Rock Springs.
Yeah.
In the summer.
Rock Springs is definitely its own animal. But
yeah, you got to be tough to live there.
My mom's family, they're originally from Laramie, but in the 70s, they moved to Rock Springs. And so they worked the oil field and had trucking companies and stuff. And so they're pretty tough people.
Yeah, you have to be. I mean, there's a reason why there's not 500,000 people in the whole state of Wyoming.
Yeah,
it's hard to make a living there because the weather, well, and like, you know, east of the Bighorns, it's like pretty desolate in the southeast corner of Wyoming. Like,
yeah,
it's kind of like Arizona. Like, it takes a lot of country to run one pair, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of nothing in between.
I always talk about, you know, like the drives, like, you know, if you've driven around, you go from Evanston to Rock Springs, from Rock Springs to Rawlins, Rawlins to Laramie. You know, those are all like 100-mile stretches of basically nothing. And then, you know, you go from Casper to Shoshone or like Lusk to Newcastle or like those long stretches, you know, and there's nobody out there. I mean, you better have a full tank of gas,
yeah,
when you start out, you know.
Yeah.
So it's always,
you want to have miles, snacks and supplies for sure.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing.
Yeah. And in the wintertime, I mean, you better be prepared to, you know, you never know what you're going to encounter. So,
well, yeah, the wind blows so much. Like I've been like had to turn around, you know, and like barely make it back on fuel because you get almost to where you think you're going to get going. Like, oh, I might make it to Casper. And then it's like, nope, the road's blown shut.
Yeah.
It's like, yikes. Got to get back to Shoshone.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, I loved Wyoming, man. I moved there right out of high school, moved to Jackson, which of course is like, we're outside of Jackson. And then, I got a job in Tinsleap, Wyoming. I loved it there.
Yeah.
That's beautiful country. The Bighorns are really cool.
Yeah, that's a cool area.
Yeah, all the red cliffs, it's like kind of surreal. You think you're in southern Utah, you know, because it's the contrast of all those red rocks and then the mountains right there too. Like, it's really neat country.
Yeah, I've lived at quite a few different places, and Wyoming's, I always say the geography is so diverse in a short span. You know, it's not like in Montana, everything's real big, and Alberta's even more like that. I mean, there's a lot of prairie and not a lot of mountains, but Wyoming, you get all that stuff and it's packed into that one little state.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not a small state, but I mean, yeah, you got, you know, everything from sagebrush to
canyons, sand dunes.
Yeah, everything.
To like the Grand Tetons, which are the most recognizable mountain range in the Rocky Mountains, you know, it's like,
yeah,
super diverse, but also super hard to make a living.
Yeah.
Like you got to be creative and hardy and willing to do about anything to survive just the weather, right? Like, everything's treacherous there because it's like so far in between anything, you know? It's pretty cool. I love Wyoming.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I'm tough enough anymore.
Yeah. Well, there's a reason that it's not really that populated. I know that, but
yeah, there's reasons for it. We don't need to get into because we both have a warm place in our hearts for Wyoming. It sounds like,
yeah,
good people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wyoming wasn't good for me because of the winters and how early it got dark and I didn't have like TV or nothing. So I just got drunk every night.
Yeah.
You know, because you get done feeding by before five, you know, in the winter. And then it's like, now what? Yeah. Single guy, 15 miles from town. Like my bar tab at the 10 Sleep Saloon was bigger every month than my paycheck.
Yeah. Just hand your paycheck over to the barmaid.
Pretty much. Yeah. But what did you like high school rodeo or what was your involvement with like horses and cows or? Like growing up, I mean, obviously your folks had a saddle shop and stuff like that, but
yeah. So, you know, we always had a, like I say, we moved around a lot and, I don't know, I would say in the early to mid 80s, we, moved down on the Laramie River and there was a place that my dad, you know, I think he worked for that guy. They were sort of absentee owner. They had some cows and my mom and dad had some sheep and put up some hay and dad was still brand inspecting and you know that was a real good time for me and my brother because
you have one brother older or younger?
Older brother. Yeah. He's just like 2 years older.
Oh, so you're real close.
Yeah. Yeah. And we were pretty tight. And we ran wild down there, you know, on the river just
having fun, yeah, boys.
Barefoot and just killing stuff and eating it and just grew up, you know, pretty feral. And, you know, just the whole livestock deal and everything. And so we go through that time and horses, you know, dad cowboyed and roped and mom, she stayed home and with us kids and worked the place and stuff like that. And then, like I said, we moved around quite a bit. Just, I don't really know why, just from place to place, renting here and there and everywhere. And anyway, we ended up, like I said, east of Wheatland. And you know, my brother, started riding some colts and dad was, you know, pretty fair with a colt. And then I, you know, had to do it too. And so we started riding some colts and dad, he was a good roper. He wanted us to rope, like team rope and stuff. And so, but when we got old enough to ride bucking horses, the roping stopped and.
Different rush.
Yeah. So the whole, like answer your question, the rodeo deal, we started riding bucking horses and.
Like in high school?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because high school rodeo is such a big thing in the western states and Wyoming. Like,
yeah,
that's what kind of what you did in spring, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So we started rodeoing and my brother, when he was a freshman, he went to state finals and
oh, dang.
He got kicked in the head. And I mean, that wasn't a serious injury per se, but it kind of chilled his drive to be a bronc rider for a while. So I kind of picked up, you know, when I started, was a freshman and started riding broncs and anyways, like my junior, senior year, I went to nationals and, you know, onward from there, I went to college and college rodeoed and my brother college rodeoed too.
Where'd you go to do that at?
Eastern Wyoming College in Torrington.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. We both went to welding school. That was going to be our big ticket for, you know.
Making all the money.
Make some money and...
Well, yeah, because, I mean, in Wyoming, like, the oil fields, you know, pretty prevalent there. So, welding jobs are, like, for guys that grew up like you and I, like, that's big money.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, learning that trade and stuff was a big, you know, big deal for us. But
and you rode saddle bronc horses?
Yeah.
Both of you?
Yeah. And then I, you know, bought my permit and got my card and PRCA rodeoed until I was about 26. And
oh, dang, you did it for a while.
Yeah, I rode saddle broncs for 10 years, basically 10 or 11 years. And then I quit. And
in the Mountain State Circuit or?
Yeah. But, and then I, after that, I rode ranch broncs for a long time after that. Just
couldn't let go of that.
Yeah. So.
Were you, what did you love about it?
About bronc riding?
Yeah.
Just.
Everything?
Yeah. I mean, a guy gets hooked on adrenaline, you know, and just the challenge. And I mean, I don't know, man, like just riding bucking horses is, it's addicting. I'm going to say like, I was never a great saddle bronc rider.
See, but I've heard different stories about that. I've heard you were really good.
No, I don't know. I mean, I could get stuff rode and slash away at the right ones or whatever, but as far as figuring out a real classy style or anything like that, I was pretty gritty. And but when I started riding ranch broncs, it kind of, you know, that was kind of my thing, and I was pretty good at it. And so I found some success, and man, I just loved it, you know. And so I just kind of, well, I mean, it started out just at the ranch rodeos
doing. Sure. And somebody on the ranch rodeo team had to climb on the bronc, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but then they started holding, you know, standalone events where it was ranch bronc riding, and, you know, and I really liked the idea that a lot of those guys, you know, especially at the beginning, were just like you and I, just like ranch guys that, you know, came to town and try to ride a bucking horse, you know, and that was, you know, the cool thing, you know, be me or my brother or guys I grew up with. I mean, we all kind of came from the same place, and it was a cowboy deal. Like, you know, you weren't just a specialized ranch bronc rider. You were just a cowboy that
rode, to do it,
rode colts and cowboy. And so to come to town and to do that, I don't know. It just, there was a draw. Definitely a draw.
I've recently in this journey found, like, kind of investigating, you know, why I did the things that I did. And because I rode bareback horses, like, right out of high school, right? Because it was like football, basketball's over, now what? And so my senior year that spring, I went to a bareback riding school, and I was like, oh, yeah. Because my identity, like, I was like, I'm not a football player and a basketball player. And I grew up on ranches, so I had the cowboy thing already. But also needing that, like, what am I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
But dude, I was just addicted to the shindig. I wasn't that good, you know what I mean? But I loved the culture and the lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
I loved living out of the car and, you know, entering the rodeos and figuring out pro com. And like back in those days, you know, because I'm freaking old, you had to call in,
yeah.
You know, and then, you know, I had all these guys that had their cards and I got my permit would enter me in the buddy system. So I was getting in rodeos that I shouldn't have been in and getting mm-hmm. on good horses. And like, I freaking loved it. I didn't like getting on bucking horses, but I loved everything else about it.
Right.
And then there's guys like you who actually did it because you loved to ride broncs. And that was hard for me to like get through in my own head, was like, I didn't even like it. Like, I didn't crave it.
Mm-hmm.
I just, man, I loved the party. I loved the lifestyle. I loved the girls. I loved especially pro rodeos, because then they had like Crown Royal tents, and
yeah.
If you're a contestant tent, in the contestant tent, everything was free. You know what I mean? It was like, what's better than this?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So I always admired guys like you that did it for, because you loved getting on broncs.
Well, I mean, I think at one point, and well, I know it, you know, I thought if I could figure this deal out and I could get good enough at it, you know, that would be my ticket to, you know, something outside of where I was, you know, and it's not that where I was like super horrible or anything like that, but I mean.
But we're also at that age trying to prove to ourselves what we're capable of, right?
Yeah.
Like my dad didn't make it this far doing this or that, or, you know what I mean? Like, we're testing ourselves at that stage of life of like, what can I do? How can I find my own way?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a part of it. We don't know it at the time, but
yeah,
maybe now we know it a little bit more, you know?
Oh yeah. Looking back, it's, you know, it's pretty plain, but at the time, I mean, you just wanted to, you know, just wanted to be something, be someone, get out and, you know, and you heard the stories of the guys that, you know, they lived on shoe leather and then they made it, you know, and then they were like a world champion and like, mm-hmm. you wanted that fire in your belly, you know, to drive you to that, you know, point. And, you know, I worked at it and practiced hard and, you know, tried to stay physically fit. And I wrestled for a little while just for the plain fact that I wanted to be in shape. I was not good at wrestling and, but just stuff like that.
Yeah.
But
was it a hard transition to go from riding saddle bronc horses to stock saddle?
No, it was actually, you know, just a technique. Like, I struggled riding saddle broncs because I rode so many colts. And so, like, when you ride colts, you try to kind of give them their head and try to, you know, when they blow up or whatever, you just ride them a little different and kind of get up over top of them. And I mean, in bronc riding, you got to learn how to lift on your rein and get back and stay back. And I struggled with that my whole career. But then when I started riding ranch broncs, I could hang on with my rope hand and I learned to stay real square and get underneath of my rein and stuff. And, you know, I could spur one in the top of the neck in my stock saddle.
Dang, that's hard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that, and then I started having fun, you know, because I also,
because it started slowing down.
Yeah. Everything started kind of coming together. And I was like, man, I wish I'd have had this figured out when I was riding saddle broncs, but it was, you know, I just never got to that point. And so
I had this, when I lived in Tin Sleep, I ran around with this guy named Dean Schlottman. I don't know if you know Dean.
Yeah, I know Dean.
But I kind of met him at the end of his bronc riding career, and he tried to ride some stock saddle broncs, and he's like, he was the opposite. He's like, it's a whole different deal. He could not figure it out. And then after a while, he kind of did, and him and I started some colts together, and if anything was threatening to buck, like Dean, you know, he's like wang leather. That dude's so tough.
Yeah.
And it was funny to me because he would bring his saddle that he won at Houston and brand new and put on all these colts and they're flipping over on it, rolling and crashing into the panels. And he didn't care about none of it. But once he did transition, man, that dude could ride a colt that would blow up like nothing I'd ever seen at the time. But I had a lot of fun with that dude.
Yeah, that guy's a cowboy.
He is a cowboy. Like, when I think of Wyoming cowboy, you know, like, you know, the Arizona cowpunchers, I have kind of a vision of what they are, and then the, you know, desert buckaroo guys. But when I think of Wyoming, like the epitome of a Wyoming cowboy,
Dean Schlottman,
I think of Dean Schlottman and Junior Johnston.
Yeah.
Do you know Junior?
You know, I've met him. Yeah.
That dude's my hero. Cause he lived in Tin Sleep when I was there. Cause he was from Casey originally, you know, and he kind of took me under his wing when I got there and took me to all the local Brandons and stuff. And I mean, he's like in his 70s, still team roping and riding colts. And like, yeah, those two guys are like heroes to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. So were you still living in Wyoming when you were like doing all that, when you were rodeoing and stuff?
Yeah. Like I said, I rode broncs till I was 26. And then when I was 27, I got married and I moved to Canada and I got married to a Canadian girl.
Somebody told me that you lived in Canada. I'm like, no, it's a different guy.
Yeah.
I know.
15 years.
Wow. I
lived up there, yeah.
Did you meet her at a rodeo?
No. This is kind of a long story, but to shorten it up, my folks split up when I was 21, I think.
Oh, dang.
21. And anyway, my dad ended up moving to Alberta. And anyway, he was up there, and I went up for Christmas one year to see him, and I met her there. then. So we dated kind of long distance for a year. And then we got married in the spring of 08.
And then you moved, like got your dual citizenship and all that, and moved up there?
Yeah, I moved up there and got married and then applied for my paperwork and got my permanent residency or whatever.
What were you doing while you were up there?
Started out because I didn't have a work permit or anything. So I was just riding colts at a place up there. And she worked for the government. Once I got my paperwork, I took a job on a community pasture and worked there for a couple of years. And then the winter after the second year, I worked at that community pasture, which was just a riding job deal. I was working for a ranch, calving a bunch of cows. And she had a brain tumor when she was a kid, and it came back that winter, went in for a checkup, and her folks ranched up there too. And so she quit her job and had to have a brain surgery and started going through some treatments and stuff like that. And so I ended up moving out to their place and working for them. And timelines, I'm not going to get into it really, but for a while that I was there, and we were there, and then ended up just renting a place from some friends. And for a short time, I worked in a welding shop in town, and then I hung my shingle out as a colt starter and a horseshoer, and did that for I don't know how long. And then we ended up getting our own place and had some cows, and I ran my business starting colts and shoeing and, you know, helping her folks, and ran a few cows. So I don't know, I just kind of went through a lot right there. But anyway, I guess the story is she had 5 different surgeries during that time.
Oh, dang.
And did some pretty heavy duty treatments. She was never like super ill or anything like that, which I was thankful for. And then 2014, she had her last surgery, and, anyway, they had a major bleeding problem when they did the last one, and she, passed away in 2014. So, so that was kind of a, you know, and here we are, like, I don't want to, as I tell the story, like, this isn't about a self-pity thing or poor me or whatever. I mean, I think deep down, just from the way I was raised or whatever, I was kind of, I would do some self-pity things and stuff like that. But, and I don't know, we could probably go back in this and talk about the way I grew up and stuff like that too. But, yeah, we will, maybe we should go back.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm just like, I didn't know that, man. I'm so sorry. That's like, I can't even imagine. I'm just like kind of putting myself in your shoes of like, nothing's worse. I mean, what could be worse than that? That's a big deal. I don't look at it as like you're like having pity on yourself. Like, that's a big deal, dude. Like, man, how do you navigate that?
Yeah, it was definitely a hard thing to walk through.
Yeah. So you want to jump back into like some stuff that you recognize now about growing up that started showing up or something?
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, what I want to talk about with you today is, you know, I've had a struggle with addiction and alcohol in my life, you know, and that, you know, stems back to, you know, like when I was growing up, you know, and I know we talked about this before we started, but, you know, I love my parents a lot. I really do. I love my mom and I love my dad. And I know that they did the very best that they could with what they had to work with mm-hmm. when I was growing up. But, you know, if I can tell my story and it can help somebody else that's out there that struggles, one person, I mean, that's why I want to do this. And this isn't to point fingers at me or anyone else. So at some level, you know, both of my parents came from, you know, tough homes, some dysfunction, things like that. And they're, you know, my mom struggled with alcoholism. It's, you know, her family struggled with it. Both sides of my family's had alcoholism. And I don't know how to get, I want to be able to tell this right, and I don't want to take forever doing it, but I have a serious hurdle to overcome, and I'm overcoming it, but I'm still working on it with like my emotional state and my spiritual state, which I tie to partially my genetics, the way God made me. I'm very empathetic. I'm an empath. I feel strongly, very deeply. I feel I'm a very sensitive person, you know, and I know that in my parents' relationship, you know, they maybe didn't get what they needed from each other. They were just kids when they got married. I mean, they didn't know jack shit about each other. Mm-hmm. They didn't know anything about life, you know, and I understand that, but.
Especially if they both came from highly dysfunctional families, right? Like it was never modeled to them what it looked like to do it right, probably.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, it's just the way it was. And, So I felt like in my home, mom was kind of the enforcer, you know, and we were expected to, and this is just the way I remember it. So, I mean, whether that's the way everybody else remembers it, it doesn't matter. This is my experience, but, you know, we were expected to, you know, toe the line and be respectful and, you know, work hard and yada, yada, yada. And I mean, I'm not saying I got beat. I mean, but dang sure got your lickings every time that you needed it. And maybe when you didn't, dad, he didn't need to lay a hand on you. He, you know, my heart was so soft that he would, if he was disappointed in me, I would just
way worse than it just kill me.
Yeah. You know, and anyway, so on one level, I'm, you know, I respected the authority of my parents and the authority of my mom. And, but she struggled with her drinking, you know, and then I also felt emotionally responsible for her because, you know, a lot of times, when she was drinking, you know, she would open up to me about my dad or certain things. And, and I'd try to help, you know, I want to help and I want to make you feel better, you know? So I began to manage her emotions.
It's a lot of weight.
I began to manage her emotions and that set into motion the rest of my life where I, you know, if I'm around someone who's emotionally unstable or upset or whatever, I mean, I'm the one that's got to fix this.
Well, I think the word is I've learned is codependency, right? Like if they're not okay, there's no way in hell you can be okay. Mm-hmm. And that's because of that like tender place of how you were designed. Mm-hmm. And then it's met with like your mom needing somebody because dad probably wasn't there for her to be that guy mm-hmm. to process through any emotions. And you were the safe place for her to land. And it like the byproduct of that is codependency. And then you learn that's a learned kind of behavior, right? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, sometimes it's for me anyway, it carried on the rest throughout my life, right?
Yeah. Well, and you don't know that those pathways in your brain.
Well, it's subconscious, dude, right?
Yeah.
Like you don't know it, especially when you're a little boy. You're like, your heart's broken for mom. Mm-hmm. And then you're just trying to go around. You become a people pleaser at some point, I would imagine, dude, too, right?
That term is me. Like, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I have been a people pleaser my whole life. And until, you know, and we can get into later on, but I just, yeah. So, yeah. And I mean, my brother and I mean, we felt like we were left alone with that situation, you know? Not that I don't think dad ever, you know, dad never wanted to like abandon us or hurt us or anything like that. But that's what it felt like because, you know, we would come home from school and she'd be, you know, drunk and, you know, I know that she's got some, you know, demons of her own because, you know, she didn't drink and just become like, you know, like a little bit drunk or something. I mean, she would switch and it was like a very spiritual thing. And she was very angry and resentful. And I can, you know, I can assume some things and I know, you know, things that I've never been told, but I think that I know why and it doesn't matter. But anyway, so, and then you'd, you know, go through this, like this thing with this person. And it's just like, you know, and it's just, it's horrible. You know, you're cornered in the kitchen and there's just like all this stuff coming out. And then, you know, we didn't want her to get in trouble. So we'd try to like help hide from dad. And then the next day, you know, and then there's, it's this person that you're supposed to, you know, respect. And you've been taught to like, you know, we were like, seen and not heard and like, oh, your boys are so good, you know, and well, and it's, I'm not saying that it was like we weren't beat, but it was pretty strict, you know. But then the next day it was like, well, you know, she'd come in and be like, well, will you please forgive me? I'm a terrible mom. And
guilt trip a bit.
Yeah. And so, oh yeah, you know, and it's like, so you're torn, you're lying to yourself. What you should have said is, and you know, you're just a kid, but I mean, that's the part I played in that was like, I could have stood up and said, you know what, this isn't okay. And, you know, I don't want this to happen anymore. And if it does, like, I'm going to tell somebody or, you know, but we never did that. It was like, you know, you, oh yeah, I'll forgive you. And well, then it happens again. And then, oh yeah,
well,
it's okay. And then it happens again. And then pretty soon you're like, you've learned to let someone treat you poorly and to be okay with it and to lie and hide about it, you know? And
it's manipulation, really.
Yeah. And whether or not, I mean, like I said, I'm not saying that like she was like evil and trying to manipulate you like that. It was just the way it was happening, you know? And I mean, she had her struggles, of course. And I mean, I'm empathetic to that, but like I said, the whole reason that I'm sitting here talking about this is because it created in me a real hard place. And I've had to navigate that as an adult, struggling with my own addiction and like, why, you know, why do I think the way I do? Why do I feel the way I do? Why do I allow people to treat me the way I do? And I've had to start answering these questions and I cannot fix this unless I look at the truth. And so the truth is that that's what happened and that's the way it was. So, you know, we've got to move forward from that.
Yeah. Also, most of my like childhood pain came from women, and my mom left, and most of my sexual abuse, not all of it, but was by women who were in charge of me. And it happened over and over again. And I drug that into every relationship with women that I had subconsciously, that I didn't trust them. I'm like, there's no way that I can trust you, or, you know what I mean? Like, I'll burn this bridge down before I ever like would let it get too far. And I drug all that into my marriage. And I guess my question is, like, with some hindsight, like kind of having all of that weight as a little boy and like trying to navigate your mom and having compassion for her, but her still showing up this way all the time, and the weight of all of that, did you feel like you took that into relationships with women, like as you went through high school and got older and got married at all?
Yeah. I mean, 100%. And, I guess how I could speak to that is, deep down, I didn't trust him. And deep down, I didn't really respect him. And deep down, and then on that subconscious level, like if I encounter a strong woman, like I can't function around that. Like I'll do whatever I can to like make sure that like, if, you know, instead of like having a boundary and saying no to someone, I couldn't do it.
Right. Sure.
You know,
how could you,
you know? And that's so, yeah. And there's just the emotional, unrest and pain that would come up at certain times over nothing, you know, and, you know,
It wasn't nothing. It was just like, you didn't know what it was from at the time. Right. Like,
yeah,
it came from somewhere, but you don't know what you don't know in the moment.
Yeah,
I mean, that you do now.
It wasn't like a big deal to anybody else, but yeah. I would feel like I was going to die.
Yeah. That pressure in your chest. Like, mm-hmm. Dude, I know that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's pretty tough, man. I mean, it's such a weird space of being absolutely loving someone and the tension of like having compassion and loving someone and having grace for someone, but also, like you said it really well, like, but also if we're not honest about the pain, if we keep like sweeping that all under the rug, like it just keeps showing up. It's mm-hmm. just going to show up in the next relationship. It's just going to show up in the next whiskey bottle. Like that's getting to the root of like, but we're so not good at holding tension, mm-hmm. especially as men, right? Like, how can two things be true at once?
Mm-hmm.
How can I love my mom so much and have compassion and understand parts of her story and journey and childhood and the way she was raised and carry that compassion for her? But at the same time, like, this was effed up.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't my fault.
Mm-hmm.
And you did this to me and put me through this. And like, it messed me up because of this. And I think that we just sweep that under the rug and like avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, I don't know if that makes sense or not, yeah. But it's that tension of two things being true at once that are in opposition of one another, kind of like having this deep pinned aggression towards someone, but at the same time, like it's my mom and I love her.
Well, yeah. And I think, to speak to that, the way that I can describe that is it builds a lot of anger and resentment.
Resentment.
And so then therein we bring in the alcoholism. And I mean, if anybody knows, the death of every alcoholic is resentment,
mm-hmm.
you know? And if you don't deal with that resentment, you know, it will eat you alive and you will die from it.
So what was your relationship with alcohol like in high school?
You know, I just remember, you know, I've kind of gone through this in my mind. When I was in high school, I I kind of, I don't know if I, I'm shied away from it is not the right word because I definitely didn't, but I was aware that.
Of what its power was.
I was aware of what its power was. But I mean, from the time I was, you know, I can remember like, I think I was like 14 and we were driving home from town and, you know, dad stops at the liquor store, drive through liquor store, gets himself a six pack. And my dad drank quite a bit, but I'd never known him to be like drunk. You know, I remember him being like drunk one time, like, and not that he didn't get drunk. I'm just saying that I don't remember,
yeah.
You know, it wasn't a significant thing, but, and he bought like a big can of Foster's for me and my brother to split, you know, on the way home. And we're like, oh yeah, right, cool. And, you know, me and my brother both have a different story of the same thing. But all I remember is that, like, I kind of hogged it, you know, and I just remember I liked that feeling, you know. And I was kind of drunk when we got home and we had to, like, hang out for a while before I went to the house because
you know, dad didn't want to get in trouble.
Yeah.
Didn't want to get his ass beat by mom.
Right. And so, I mean, with all that I know about alcohol and alcoholism, I would say that I drank alcoholically from the first drink that I took. You know, I didn't necessarily like the taste, but I liked the way that it
felt.
Yeah.
Like, heck yeah, dude.
And all that.
Well, especially that, but that's also such a double-edged sword, right? Like, it's the thing that's like tearing you apart inside and the same thing that's rescuing you at the same time. Like, that's messed up.
Yeah.
Dealing with mom and what it's causing and seeing it every, like seeing it, mm-hmm. experiencing it, feeling it. Mm-hmm. Isn't it crazy though? But it's mm-hmm. the same thing that's rescuing you at the same time and causing pain. Like,
yeah,
it's jacked up.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, I guess I've thought about that a little bit, but when you say it right now, like that, you know, going through that picture in my mind of like, you know, her whiskey bottle on the table and that thing that you go through. But then when they would leave, it was like you'd pull that whiskey bottle out and take a nip, you know, like, oh yeah.
It's like watching somebody get bit by a snake and they leave and you're like, I'm going to go pick up that snake. And you just watch them get bit by that rattlesnake. Like,
right. It's insane.
Like, it's insane, dude.
Yeah.
Like, if you get one DUI, like, okay, I'm not doing that again. Right. Like, but there's something about that addictive thing and that thing that it makes you feel that's like, all logic is out the window.
Yeah.
It's gone, right? It doesn't make sense.
No, and it's not. And, but then, you know, the screwed up thing is we can build this picture bigger is like the culture that we live in. And I mean, I've heard guys say, well, you know, I'm not going to sit here and bash on alcohol. And well, I will. Like, the culture that we live in is like
celebrated.
They're obsessed with alcohol. I mean, every sport event, every billboard, every commercial, like, you know, and I mean, I'm growing up, I'm just like you, like we're cowboys, right? We want to be cowboys. And I mean, we're going to chew Copenhagen and drink Coors, like, you know, and we're going to have a good time and we're going to freaking ride Bronx and we're going to chase girls and we're going to drive fast and we're going to have all these stories to tell our friends.
That's it.
You know, and that, so then it's like, but we got to drink to do this. But then you go home and you experience this like drunken human that just tears your soul out. And, you know, you don't, like, you don't put it together, you know, because that person is in a place of torment and turmoil and you're not there yet. So you want the good time. And that's
the lie, right?
Yeah.
Of like, well, at least I'm not like that person. I got this under control.
Yeah.
That's the lie that we buy into because we have to make sense of it, mm-hmm. of the rattlesnake watching it bite mom. Mm-hmm. Like, well, at least I'm immune to this rattlesnake bite. I can play with it. She can't, but I can.
Yeah.
And like, because we got to fix it up in our brain for it to make sense of why it's like makes sense, why it's feasible.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we run into that. And I mean, this is jumping way ahead, but like with alcoholics and stuff like that, it's just like, And some people, a lot of people are going to disagree with this, but I will say that, you know, it's like, well, you know, Henry can't drink, but Jimmy can. And it's like, well, when Henry drinks, he gets messed up and he wrecks the car and misses Christmas, but it doesn't improve Jimmy's life either. You know, it's not like, well, it's good for one and bad for one guy. It's like, it's not good for anybody. It's poison and it screws you up. It screws up your life. And to what extent? I mean, that depends on, you know, a lot of things, your spiritual, emotional state, your genetics, you know, whatever. But I don't haven't met a person yet who was like, man, I'm really glad that I drink. You know, I'm really glad that, you know, my life really got better when I started drinking, you know.
And yeah, I love that term, like functioning alcoholic. Like, what does that mean?
Right? Yeah.
I get it. Like, I could kind of keep a job and be a full-time drunk. So I guess I was a functioning alcoholic, but I've never met a functioning alcoholic.
No. Right? It's just messed up. And that's the lie, you know, even in recovery, it's sort of a lie that goes along with some recovery. It's like, well, you know, yeah, we are different, you know, because when I start drinking, I don't stop until, you know, a certain point. I can't quit and I don't want to quit. That's the thing. And, but yeah, so I'm different in that way, but it's not like the next guy that, you know, he can quit after two or three beers. Does those two or three beers really improve his life, you know, and give him 10 years, give him 15 years, give him 20 years. Where's it going to be?
Well, it's poison, however you want to dice it up. Right. Mm-hmm. Like it. Yeah. That's cool. If you have a glass of wine with dinner or something, like, okay, if it, you know, you like the little warm fuzzy that comes with it and you can go a month without having to have that.
Sure.
Cool. I can't.
Yeah.
What, kind of jumping back into your story, like, so like when you first got married and everything, where was your drinking at then?
So that's a, you know, that's a sort of a painful thing for me is, like when I met my first wife, I was 26. I was 26. And, you know, I look back in my story and I mean, honestly, to be truthful, I'm a full blown alcoholic by the time I'm 21. Mm. And I'm not saying like I'm drunk every day and I'm not drinking full time, but you know, I drink alone a lot because I was alone a lot, you know, and that's what I did. And so, you know, and did that affect my rodeo career? Absolutely. Mm. Could I have made things better and different in my life with that? I think so. Did I know it at the time? No, I mean, that's what we're doing when you're partying and rodeoing. And I mean, there was always those people trying to guide you, like, don't go that direction. And it was like, you know, but you just kind of veered into that stuff and, you know, it gets a hold of you. And so to answer your question, like by the time I got married, like, and this is just the truth is, I don't think my first wife knew about my drinking or how much I actually drank. You know, before we got married, we had a long distance relationship and
easy to hide.
Yeah. You know, I was a hider. I could hide it. And, so with that being said, I struggled through those times. And I would, you know, hide it the best I could, but every function or social interaction was like, you know, I drank, you know, a lot, and we had problems with it over that. And, you know, I've got to come to terms with a little bit of guilt that I still carry over that. And all the stress that I put on her with my, you know, episodes, I would call them, 'cause I was kind of a binge drinker. Did that influence her health? You know, I don't know. That's a question I can, you know, that I'll probably never know the answer to. But yeah, that was how it was. But when we, I think I was 31, I had an episode and she was going through, you know, her time with her, you know, brain surgeries and stuff. And I started going to AA. And so I didn't drink for 6 years and I was sober. For 3 years before she passed away, which I'm thankful for.
Yeah, dude, that was a gift.
Yeah, I'm really thankful for that.
Good job, man.
Well, I went to AA. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't work the steps. I wouldn't say I was emotionally sober at all, but I...
You were white-knuckling sobriety.
I was alcohol-free, you know, and I was able to fill the role the best I could to do what I could do for her. And, but you know, with the alcoholism and that mindset, you're very selfish. You're very self-centered. You function out of a lot of fear. And you know, I just remember different things. I don't need to talk about them, but I was very selfish in a way. I mean, I looked after things. I was very, you know, I looked after things. Did I look after her like emotionally? I probably lacked in that area.
Well, you probably didn't know how.
Well, I mean,
right?
We're all on a journey.
Yeah. So. You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. And now that I've, you know, returned to the program and I've opened up some of these things by working some steps and working with a sponsor. I mean, I see how my mindset is and it's like, oh my God, like my character defects are like, they're so big and deep in me. And, you know, there's a part of me that's like, no, they're not, because I'm a nice guy. I'm a nice guy. Everybody likes me. I'm a people-pleasing son of a gun, and I can manipulate everybody around me to like me, you know? And I learned how to do that from a very young age, you know? But to actually be honest about it is, you know, I can be very self-centered and selfish. And, I mean, in a way, I was then, you know? So...
How long did you stay in Canada after your wife passed?
I think 7 years.
7 years? And you stayed sober for 3 more years after that?
Yeah.
Did you stay on her family place?
We had our own, place.
Oh yeah. You were just kind of helping out over there occasionally. Yeah.
We had our own place that they had helped us to get and stuff. And then I ended up, you know, I stayed there. I don't know why. I mean, who knows? For a while, I stayed there for another year. And then I owned it for another year after that. And ended up moving to Southern Alberta. And I took a job at a community pasture down there. And right before that is when I met Paige, my second wife. So, and we were together for, gosh dang, I'm probably going to get this wrong, but I think like 8 years, 6 years before we got married. But,
I mean that, I want to kind of move past this, but I just like, your wife passes away and you stayed sober for 3 years after that. Like, that's pretty amazing, man. Like I don't think I could have done that.
I don't know. I mean, maybe you could have. I don't know.
Because I mean, you go through this humongous tragedy, and then like the old coping mechanism was drinking, and the fact that you stayed that course is like, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, I don't know.
What you replaced? Like after that, like how did you make it through that season? Did you have like really close friends? Did you just work hard all the time? Like how did you cope with that? I could understand if you're like, yeah, I started drinking again, and I would be like, oh, I get that. But I'm like, I'm interested in like that process of like, did you just like work like crazy, or were you around some good people, or
I was around. I had a pretty close, I had some close people in my life, some neighbors and stuff. And I mean, I was adrift. And let me tell you, like when I moved up there, you know, I mean, I was born and raised in Wyoming, and then I moved not only out of the country, but to a different culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're all the same, but you know, it's different. It's Canada. It's in the, you know, in that type of country. It's not the wide open prairie. It's not the mountains. It's kind of like swamps and forests and small places. And you know, there's some really good people up there and some good cowboys and stuff like that. But I had such a addiction to the West and the romance of history, and like, you know, just the cowboy deal was like, you know what it's like, that fire that burns in your belly, you know, and I, that kind of got threatened. And so I was really, for a while, I think, and that's part of what, you know, I drank about too, was I missed Wyoming, you know, I missed it. And so once I was on my own, I didn't know what to do. You know, I knew, I'd been sober or alcohol free long enough that I didn't, you know, I didn't really want to drink. You know, I think that slowly there was a little bit of, you know, in the back of my mind was like, oh, maybe I could, you know, but I was pretty good at just shoving that away. I didn't know it at the time. I know some friends have, you know, told my wife now, like, man, Matt was real, you know, he was real hard and angry back then. And I didn't know that really, but I was very hard, and deep down I was very angry. And that's when I was like kind of right in the middle of my ranch bronc riding. And I mean, something would jump up underneath me and I could like just hammer them. And
there's your outlet.
My teeth were grit. And I mean, I was just like, you know, and that's a good point. That was my outlet.
Cause it all pinned up and it was like, you could really let it loose.
Yeah. And then
in kind of a healthy way too.
Yeah.
I mean, better than fist fighting, you know?
Yeah. Well, I've never been a fighter, but, yeah. So, and that's a good point, I guess. And, because that right around that time, I was like, I would go to these ranch bronc ridings, and, you know, that was, I really liked it. I really liked to, and I'd scrape them up, you know, and, I kind of sat on the couch for a while too. I was just like, I didn't know what to do. I had some money, so I didn't have to work. And I had a lot of things to work through and to go, you know, to handle, I guess, business wise. And I mean, I don't know. It's a real weird place to be in.
It's a lot of processing.
Yeah. That grief and, you know, yeah. And so then, man, I'm just kind of stumbling a little bit here, but
we can kind of move back to where you were. So you moved south, but still in Canada, and met your now wife, but you guys dated for 7 years, you said, or a while.
Yeah. I think we were together for like 6 years before we got married.
And that whole time you were in Canada.
Yeah.
When did you guys move to Wyoming after you, or move back to the States after you got married?
Yes. Well, right at the same time. It was kind of all at the same time. So it would have been 2016 when, you know, we kind of started going together. And then that the fall of 2016, I'd been making trips down to Wyoming in the wintertime because I didn't want to spend any more winters in Canada. Not that Wyoming is that much better, but it is.
Yeah.
And so I'd go down there and stay with my brother and visit my mom and stuff like that. And I don't know, Paige and I, we went down and kind of made a big tour. I had some music stuff I was doing.
Oh, dude, we haven't even talked about that yet.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's okay.
Like, when did you pick up a guitar? We can kind of speed up right through here and get caught back up. But when did you pick up a guitar?
Well, I'll just say my dad played and sang my whole life. And I remember like him and my uncle sitting around picking and whoever, you know, around campfires and stuff like that. And, but I never really was that interested in playing the guitar until I think I was like 16 or 17. I was in high school and this kid moved into town from Nebraska and I went to lunch with him and he had a guitar in his car and he, you know, played it and sang. And I was like, man, I got to learn how to do this. And then, yeah, so I went home, picked up my dad's guitar, and he took the time to show me how to play it. And I remember going to the FFA convention that year or that fall or something, and there was a kid. He actually played with, like, you know who Chancey Williams is now, like, from Wyoming?
Oh, yeah, 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 yep, yep.
He started out with Chancey back then, and anyway, he was like up there in his FFA jacket and he was like the
shredding,
the entertainment for everybody. And I'm like, and he's just playing all the cool songs at the time and just him and his guitar. And I'm like, man, I got to learn how to do this, you know? So, but I was really creative. And I was very good at English and literature and writing. And so just through it all, I started writing my own song.
Like early on, like in high school?
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, I had my first song written before I ever learned the guitar, just
like in a poem form.
Yeah, but I would sing it.
You know, okay.
And I had the rhythm and stuff. And then anyway, and so I started playing music, writing songs. There's a lot around that too, but here we are, however many years later, I've got 7 albums out and working on another one.
Dang. So, yeah. Going through all of these things to kind of get caught back up to where we were in your story, like that was a big part of your life, right? Like the songwriting, like was that kind of an outlet too through some of these hard times?
Yeah.
It was like getting stuff down on paper and kind of working through that process of putting it to a song that kind of made sense to you and what you were going through.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't write a whole, I mean, I do remember some songs I wrote that were kind of related to the whole, you know, like the traumatic side of things, but I wrote mostly cowboy songs mm-hmm. and rodeo songs and, you know, but I've always been really, knock on wood or thank God, I've just been really good at capturing an emotion in a song, I feel like, and the listener can relate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been, you know, a big part of my success. It's just a gift. So, yeah.
Okay. So now we're kind of, I'm sorry, I forgot completely about that. I'm just like,
no, I did
so encapsulated by your journey, but
a lot.
Which also is like always strikes me because would it be fair to say that you're kind of introverted?
Very.
Yeah. So I'm always fascinated by guys like you and gals that are like introverted, but have this beautiful gift and like the courage to like step up on a stage and like deliver your art all by yourself, dude. Like that goes against everything in an introvert to do. Like yeah. It's crazy, right?
Well, and it didn't start out like that. I mean, when I was, and that's what I try to tell people, like when I was young, I mean, I was so shy, you know, and I just, like, I couldn't talk to people. I couldn't look at people. I hid from people. I was so shy. And then when I started you know, playing the guitar and like trying to do it in front of people is like brutal.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, and thank God there was people, you know, and my experience in Canada, when I moved up there, I mean, I kind of had some stuff going musically and I had a lot of songs that I'd written and stuff like that, but my public performing was very limited to like party stuff, like college or whatever, you know, and you'd be, you know, drunk. And
yeah. So you're like, hey, go grab your guitar. Yeah. Sing him that song.
Yeah. You know, but to actually be sober and like, you know, intentionally sit up in front of people and play was like
freaking hard.
Still brutal.
Yeah.
And luckily, my wife's grandpa, my first wife's grandpa, he was part of the big poetry gathering there. You know, they kept getting me to come up and play, you know, and I mean, I know I wasn't very good at performing, but they did like my songs, and I got to do all those little poetry gatherings and being in front of those people, you know, and then I got gigs like playing at the art show at the Pinocchio Stampede, and I'd sit out there for like 2 hours twice a day and play for people walking by. And I mean, I haven't toured the world, but I've put my time in at different venues.
Just like, getting reps in, man, right? Yeah,
and it's what it takes is just...
Like anything.
Hours.
Yeah.
Hours and hours. And, you know, overcoming that discomfort, all that stuff, you know, that's what shaped me, you know. And I, by no means, am an extremely great entertainer. But, you know, just today I walked out there and... You know, I can step out there, plug my guitar in, tell my stories, you know, make people laugh, make people cry, you know, and I am just so grateful for, like, you know, I've been walking through some pretty tough stuff actually lately, and, you know, just that emotional angst and pain that, you know, you're no longer numbing with a substance. When I go out on stage, it's like taking a drink. It's like I can leave the world behind me, and it can't get me. Nothing can get me right there if I own it, and I can just be in the moment and do my thing. And for whether it's 15 minutes or 45 minutes or whatever, how long I'm playing, like I'm safe and I'm in control, and it's just like it's an awesome feeling. And you know, the only thing I can say about that is I feel so grateful to be able to do that, you know.
And it's like whenever you can use your gift for good, it's like double blessed.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense, right? But it's like you get to receive a gift whilst you're giving a gift.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I feel like when I know that I'm where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
Like where it's like.
That's a good
point. I'm receiving this wonderful gift.
Yeah, because
while I'm giving a gift, like what a cool space. Back. Yeah.
Yeah. And I haven't thought about that. Thanks for bringing that up. Like, because I do, you know, we all as human beings desire that, feel that need to be wanted, that, you know, that dopamine that comes from being liked. And, you know, and I'm sure that, you know, I have my critics or whatever like that, but I, you know, the better I can do for them, you know, that's my goal. But it also, like you say, gives back to me because that's my safe space. I can get up on that stage in front of those lights and like I can own it and I can feel, I don't know, it's just I feel like safe there.
That's so cool.
What's so weird is it's so backwards from where it started though. Like, I mean, I was peeing down my leg and I remember being on stages where my legs were shaking so bad that the microphone wouldn't hold still enough for me to sing. Like, and I couldn't help it.
Yeah.
You know, but
there's something about persevering, right?
Yeah.
It's like anything that we like put our hands to, like, it's okay to like suck at something for a while. Nobody was born knowing how to do anything, right? Except for cry and like crap ourselves.
Right.
Why would it be any different as we get older? And that's why I think humility is such a big piece of the pie, the puzzle for humanity of like, I'm not going to be good at this, but I'm going to struggle through it anyway, because there's a gift at the end of this.
Yeah.
Like, this is the things that my wife and I are trying to raise our boys learning, like, lean into the hard things because it gets better.
Yeah.
And you leaning into the hard thing of your knee shaking and the mic moving, and like, now it's become a refuge.
Yeah.
The thing that scared the hell out of you is the thing now that you can go to for refuge. Like, that's beautiful, dude.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's
such a beautiful story of perseverance and not giving up, and a lesson to us all of, like, lean into the hard things.
Yeah.
Lean into the scary, because that's where the fruit lives.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sorry. I'm like taking this all over the place. So you get married in Canada, and then right after decide, let's move back to Wyoming, or?
Well, so we were together from, you know, we moved in together. I started that job in 2017 in the spring. And so we moved in together. And so, you know, she had her business, and we lived, you know, it was like 40 miles to the grocery store, long dirt road. And, but I started drinking again.
While you were dating?
Yeah. Yeah. So,
and so she met you sober.
Yeah.
And then you started easing back into her.
Well, you know how it is. Well, maybe
you don't ease back into nothing.
No, you pick right up where you left off, yeah. You know, and that's, so 2017, we went to South Dakota to a memorial deal, and I played some music there. And anyway, so I did the gig and stuff, and then we go out to eat, and, you know, I'd been like kind of thinking about it, you know, like, oh, I should, you know, talking about drinking and stuff. And she's like, well, why don't you, you know, cause she didn't know. She just knew that I didn't drink and that I called myself, you know, all these bad things. And she's like, you know, drink then, if you, you know, you keep talking about it, like, go ahead, you know, why don't you? And I'm like, yeah, you know, I think I should, you know, and blah, blah, blah. So then I lied to myself, talked myself into it. And I had a couple beers that night, and then, you know, it just snowballs after that. And I mean, you pick right up pretty much where you left off. And so, you know, and I'm going to make this about the drinking. It's not so much about my story, because, you know, I want to be able to help somebody that's struggling. But, so I start drinking again, and, you know, it's fun, right? Getting back.
When it's good, it's good.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. And, I keep working that job. It was a seasonal job, and we went to Arizona that winter. And, then I was drinking pretty heavy, and, you know, everybody would go to bed and I'd stay up and drink by myself, and, you know, just.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. Anyways, yeah. And then, so I can't remember how long I worked there now, 4 years. And the whole time, like, you know, we're as a couple, we're, you know, it's a strange thing. And I can't even put words to it, or I don't want to put words to it, where, like, we struggled together. We struggled together, and I was really resentful. And, you know, she was looking for emotional support, and I'm like,
you had nothing to offer.
Nothing. You know, and anyway, but man, we stayed together, and so then, like, my drinking became like an issue for sure. Not that it wasn't, but so now I'm, you know, hiding it, you know, which I was good at. I'd done that shit my whole,
yeah, buddy,
from the time I was a kid. I mean, you know, I could sneak around, and I mean, thank God I never got another DUI or, like, wrecked anything. I mean, I was drinking a lot, pretty hard.
Like, during the day, during work, or just at night, hiding it?
I wouldn't drink at work. And not that Not that I wouldn't drink in the day or while I was working, but just at that particular place,
it wasn't really feasible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm kind of minded my P's and Q's a little bit that way, but after work, I mean, I'm a pig. I mean, I can drink, you know, get me a 12 pack down in 15 minutes and like,
oh yeah, get there quick.
Yeah.
And that, cause it's all about getting there, right? To the point where it's like that feeling that we need to feel to where nothing really hurts anymore. Yeah. The thing that we don't even know what it is.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the race, right? Is to get to there.
Yeah. And yeah. I mean, I'm carrying so much. And I mean, we'd have to talk for a day to get all this stuff figured out, but I'm just carrying so much grief and guilt and shame and worry and fear and self-centeredness and like all this stuff is just like in me and nobody knows, you know, because I'm the people pleaser and I'm, you know, trying to be everybody's friend and I lie to myself and I lie to other people and I, you know, and it's not like I'm a dishonest chump that's trying to push one over on somebody. It's not like that. Like the dishonesty is, you know,
to yourself.
To myself. Yeah, there's people I don't want to hang out with you, but I would make myself hang out with them and I would make myself do things and I would, you know, and which that hurts them because they think that you have this relationship when deep down you don't give a shit, but you're not ever going to say to yourself like, you know what, I'm just going to pass this on by and go do my thing because like in a really weird way, you're like, I had this, and we don't need to get too far down this road either, but like I had this like Christian value where it's like, you know, Jesus would, you know, go hang out with the people that were, you know, these other people that weren't popular or whatever like that. And so anybody that I came across that like I didn't like, I would almost like make myself like them because I thought I was being Christ-like, but that's absolutely not good for you. Like, I, you know, it's not good for them because I'm lying to them, you know, and it's not like I'm going to say like, I don't like you. It's just, you're manipulating everyone around you all the time and in so many different ways. And you're lying to yourself on so many levels and you get lost in this and deep down and you can't even see it, you know, as it exposes itself, you start to see it, but deep down, when you're in it, you don't even know. The only thing that is the barometer for me was like my spiritual pain and all that pain was, you know, my solution was alcohol until it wasn't, you know, so I could numb out. I could numb the voices, like the voices in my head just kept getting louder and louder and louder and more.
Then it takes more to quiet them.
Yeah. And then it turns on itself and it's like, you know, because the nature of alcohol is like, it causes anxiety and it causes depression and it, you know, it causes
it is a depressant itself.
Yeah. So if you're already tormented and anxious, I mean, yeah, that first few minutes when it hits your system, it's going to turn the volume down. But not very long, that volume's going to get cranked. And then you're going to be like, you know, what do I do now?
Well, and so much of it too is just feeling like wrestling with your spirituality and like some barometer of it's like, I always just felt like the biggest fraud and imposter on the planet. I'm like, I'm bullshitting everyone, even believing my own bullshit half the time, right? Like, I'm not honest with anyone. Mm-hmm. I can't be.
Mm-hmm.
Like no one, there's nobody I was ever honest with. I couldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
And the self-hatred that comes along with that, right? Of like, what kind of piece of shit does the things that I'm doing?
Now I can relate.
And somehow everyone still thinks you're kind of great and okay.
Yeah.
You know, like it's such a messed up paradigm.
Yeah.
it's all built on like lies, you know, it's like, and then you're like doubling down on this lie to cover up for that one. And it's like, you just, for me, I couldn't find a way out of it anymore. Cause I didn't even know what the truth was almost, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't know who I was. Mm-hmm. I didn't know, like, I was surprised I had one friend left.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, if you only knew.
Yeah. Well,
it's like this web of lies, you know, it's like the house of cards kind of thing.
Yeah. And it's, in my case, I, you know, I've got a lot of great people in my life and, you know, knock on wood, I feel like I've been fairly talented, you know, in my life to, with my horsemanship or my music or whatever I'm doing. And, I do have a heart for people and I do love people, but that, that sort of deceitfulness that was inside me, I just, you know, it wasn't, I knew it was there, but it was like, you know, I could hide it.
Yeah. It's underlying too.
Yeah.
It's like torment.
So, you know, as we go on, I quit that job and, we moved and I rented a house and I started working at a different community pasture, but I had to drive there. And, anyway, my drinking by then was just like, you know, I'm not saying like I was a town drunk or nothing like that. I mean, there's probably a lot of people that are blown away by this, like, but as far as probably one of my closest friends, a couple of my closest friends and my wife, and they were well aware, you know, but what to do, I don't, you know, and so we're struggling, me and her, we weren't married yet. And, you know, like I say, you know, for some reason, man, that resentment that I had, and I can, you know, I'm going to trace it back to what I got when I was a kid, you know, with mom. And I poured it out on my spouse, on my, you know, on her, and that influenced the way, my friends saw her, my family saw her, because I'm kind of like, you know, manipulating, and, you know, they can disagree or whatever, they can see what they think they see or whatever, but I know in my heart, you know, I'm not going to bat on a certain level emotionally, for my significant other in this situation. I'm protecting myself.
And sometimes did you ever find you were like, maybe in subconsciously, like looking back, like making a case against her?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
To family and friends a little bit, like kind of bending the narrative a little bit to like even portray being the victim.
Man. Yeah. Can you relate with this?
Yeah. That's self-protection, right? Like when I had the big sit down and dealt with all my mother wounds with my mom, like it dawned on me, like, you know, like how you get like a horse can get like a low grade infection. So it's not like the super obvious thing, but it's like this underlying thing that's like a slow burn. And it like hit me like a brick, dude. I literally was like, I have a low grade, like this underlying hatred for women.
Yes.
My whole freaking life.
Yes.
And like my eyes opened up to like, I can't believe that I'm still even with a woman, because I've looked at every woman through these glasses, right? This narrative that I didn't know, but it was freaking hatred and self-protection. And I always bent things to protect myself, however I had to do it. And every situation was a little bit different, but I was always making sure that you stay out there where I can see you at all times.
Yeah.
I'm not letting you in. And it was like this low grade infection or this low grade hatred that I had that I didn't even really know.
Yeah. I totally relate with that. And
yeah.
And I've tried to, you know, dive into that. But I'm really, I don't know. I'm really glad that you talk about it because I can relate, you know,
Well, sometimes, Matt, it's just like understandings like healing. Like, that's what it is. Now we know. Now we can do something about it. But when we don't know what it is, how in the hell are we going to do anything about it? It's just this thing that sits in us that we can't explain. We don't know how to verbalize it. We don't know how to communicate it, even to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something that's there that we can't put a finger on. And that's why, to me, it's like, it was such a gift, I feel like, for me to like, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause now I know where I need to deep dive and get healing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can start showing up for the women in my life.
Yeah.
In a different way. And I can let go of that narrative that I've been, which was self-protective. Right. So there's like this compassion piece to myself for it of like, oh, I know how it got here.
Mm-hmm.
But now I have to own what I've done with that.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it wasn't my fault, but I've made choices that I need to be accountable for. And I got some messes to clean up.
Yeah.
And I need to get some help in how to figure out how to fight for my wife's heart.
Right.
And like right a bunch of wrongs.
Yeah.
So it's like all part of that journey of like, but first it's like, I don't even know what this is.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
Dude. Yeah, totally. I mean, and that is exactly how I was functioning. And I mean, on this side of it, I look back and I'm like, you know, thank God she stuck around, you know, through my drinking and me being an asshole. And, but I, you know, in my mind, I'm like, well, I'm not being an asshole. I'm a good guy, you know.
And I have all these friends to prove it. Because right. We can make a case, the same time we're making a case against them, we're making a case for us.
Right.
In our delusion.
Right. Right. Exactly. So, yeah, we're carrying on there. And, man, and then, yeah, so we went down to Arizona again in 2019 for the winter. And that's when COVID happened. So we go back to Canada that summer I was still at that pasture job. And then, anyway, that winter I went to Idaho and I started a bunch of colts for Simplots. I had a good friend of mine that I grew up with that worked for them, and he, kind of got me the job down there, and Paige was going to come down and stay with me. And, things got real weird with the vaccine and the border
mm-hmm.
and all this crap. And we were like, you know, that was the hill we were going to die on. Like, we're not going to get vaccinated. It was just our beliefs and what we were going to stick our sword in the sand for. So she couldn't come down. And so I was like 3 months just riding colts and just living in Bruno, Idaho. And Bruno, Idaho is a drinking community. and so that's what I basically did. I drank and rode horses and went home that spring. A fire went through and just about burned our house down that we were renting. Burnt right through the place, burned up all my hay. It was a little bit of a tough time, actually. And so that summer I worked at that other community pasture. I was driving back and forth, and that's kind of where we were at before. I'm getting back to my story. Drinking pretty good. And so, yeah, then that next winter, I was going to go back to Bruno and ride more colts. And so Paige was able to come down because she had a rodeo card. But if you weren't vaccinated and you were Canadian, you couldn't leave the country. And things were just real weird up there with like just, I don't know, just the control over the whole COVID thing. And We decided that we wanted to move back to the States. And so we come down and I'm riding colts. She enters the country as a visitor, I guess. And we got married and she applied for a green card from within the country. And there's a lot of miracles that that start happening right here because like, we didn't like go about that real proper as far as the government's concerned. But like with the Biden administration being looser on immigration, it kind of worked in our favor. So she had to wait for quite a while to get her green card, but like we didn't have to go do an interview or anything. It just showed up in the mail.
Nice.
Yeah. And anyway, so I was in Idaho riding colts for them. And I got, there's a part in this story that I have to back up a little bit. That fall, and it was alcohol related. I will say this, and I'm not proud of it, but a horse bucked me off and stepped right in the middle of my chest and broke my sternum, punctured and collapsed my lung, broke all my ribs. And
dang.
I was in the hospital for a few days. I thought I was going to die when it happened. I healed up from that. I go down to Idaho, start riding colts, and I got in a wreck and dislocated my shoulder. So I'd been kind of banged up. And so I kind of limped through the rest of that job. And I answered an ad to start some colts down in Prescott for a couple months. We go down there. I rode colts in Prescott. And when we left, made a deal to come back and kind of be on full time at that place. And anyway, so when I went to go back to Idaho, some things changed with the contract and we didn't end up finishing those colts. I ended up going back to Wyoming where my brother lived for a couple months. And I just rode some colts there and I'm still like struggling. Like we're struggling just in our marriage. Cause we got married that June in Montana and, but we're struggling and I'm struggling with my alcoholism, my mindset, a lot of depression, a lot of just tough stuff, you know. Anyway, I end up going back to Prescott and, worked there, riding colts and, getting to, you know, punch cows with those guys a little bit outside and stuff like that. And, things just got real tough for us. You know, we were having a hard time. She moved down. Some things happened, but anyway, she moved down to stay with a friend for a couple months. And I was just kind of drifting in. I stayed there, but I mean, I was just drifting in my heart. And I started really having some really dark thoughts. Like, you know, I just end it type of stuff, you know, just fuck it. And you know, man, it's like you never think you'd think like that, but once you start and it's just real dark. And I, you know, just where I was, some of the people I was around, and of course my spiritual state, my emotional state, and my alcoholism was all just, it was a swarm of just pain and darkness. And anyway, there was a kid named Cole and he came and he was working in town at the airport because he was training to be a flight instructor. And super good kid, young, 20, I don't know, he's like 22 or something like that. And just a absolutely fabulous human, comes from a good family. And he was interested in riding colts and played the guitar and we kind of struck up a friendship. And he's like, you know, I don't know. I just opened up to him and we started talking and he's like, you ever listen to this Wild Courage podcast? And I'm like, no, I never heard of it. And anyway, we started talking about Ben, a little bit, and I got Ben's phone number from Cole because he had his phone number because I had listened to the podcast after that. And anyway, I don't know if I can talk about him on here or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Ben Balow.
Yeah. And I listened to his story on the deal, and I listened to your story. I listened to all those early ones. But since Ben lived just down the road, I called him up. I got his number from Cole, and I called him up and just introduced myself. And I was like, you know, hey, I got a problem and I need some help. And he was just like, you bet, let's do it, you know? So, I go meet him. He came and rode with me, for a day. We talked over some stuff, and, we went to the gas station and sat in his truck, and he, talked over some stuff, and I think we might have read out of a book anyway. But I started going to these meetings at Skull Valley with him, or not with him, but he went there, you know, and you've been there. And he became my sponsor, and I started working these steps. And I mean, I need to do it again. I don't know how great of a job I did. I didn't quit drinking right away. I, you know, kind of started having bouts of sobriety. But shit, I was alcohol free for 6 years before that. Like, I knew I could do it. And, but it was the, by this time, it's the emotional and spiritual state I was in was like, it was like times a thousand of where I was before, you know. It sucked. And I mean, I'm having suicidal thoughts, and, you know, my poor wife is, she doesn't know what to do. I'm not there emotionally. I mean, I'm a hard worker. I'm talented. I'm getting shit done. And, but I'm getting us in these different situations where it's, you know, not good. We're trying to find a place to be, trying to find a place to, well, and then I quit working for that place, and we went out on our own, and, we're trying to find a place to ride our, you know, ride colts and stuff like that. And I mean, I built up a clientele really fast. Thank God. It has nothing to do with me. It's just like totally, once I started on this journey, this, a lot of these miracles started happening. But you know, even today, like, we're still looking to find that place, because where we are is, you know, it's short term. We're sort of in a tough spot right now. I've got a lot of clients on, my business can be booming. I just need the place to do it. And it's just, I believe it's God pushing us to find our own deal. I don't know how. And that's the whole thing through this whole thing, is there's a miracle that happened. Like, if Cole hadn't have moved into the yard and told me about the Wild Courage podcast, if I hadn't listened to that podcast and heard Ben's story and turned around and looked at Cole and said, hey, that's cool. He's like, yeah, you want his phone number? You know, like, it's just, it's all dot, dot, dot lined up. And like, I didn't get, you know, completely sober just overnight. And I mean, I'm still working on my sobriety. I've been sober for a while. But learning about my emotions and my spiritual state through AA, through other people, my wife, she has helped me so much with healing and learning, you know, about the way that I think and the way that the things that I can do for myself to just overcome. And I mean, it comes and goes. It's like, you know how it is, Jeremy. It's like, you're riding in an ocean and the waves are crashing. And I mean, sometimes you're up and sometimes you're down. And, but, you know, being alcohol free or sober, you're not, numbing those nerves. So you've got to get used to this discomfort. And that discomfort is sometimes the worst. It's so tough, but it's like that stepping out on that stage, you know. And I have to keep believing this, because tomorrow I might wake up and I might have that knife in my guts, and I have to be able to function with that, knowing that my higher power has my best interest in mind. And if I keep on this path and I keep walking forward, I'm going to find victory and I'm going to find relief. And I don't have to do it with a substance, because that substance is going to, you know, it's going to turn on me and ruin me. And there's a weird thing that happens once you start, you know, relying on your higher power. He just starts showing up, you know, and it's not like a big ooh-ha-ha religious thing either. It's like, you know, certain people come into your life, certain events happen that you can't explain. And there's some hard things you have to do. You have to have hard conversations, which is the communication and confrontation is like death for me. I would rather, die than have to communicate in a confrontational way with someone. But you have to start being able to do these things. I have to be able to start being able to do these things. But once I do, then it's like you're taking care of business, and then things start to flow and things start to happen out in front of you. And there's a reward in all of it. And it's not like, I wish I could say it was easy and it was all feel good. It's not. It sucks. It sucks. But you know what sucks worse is being drunk and living in that turmoil where, I mean, you're going to put a pistol in your mouth and pull the trigger, you know? And so, I don't know. I want to say, like, God bless my wife for walking through me through all this stuff. And hopefully she can forgive me for, you know, that picture that I paint. You know, and I mean, some people might disagree with that, but I know that when you said it's self-protection, like that deep down, you know, if I paint this picture a certain way, everybody's going to be on my side, you know, and why I did that. I mean, I know why. And I don't want to do that anymore. So anyway, we're going to make it. God's going to really deliver some great things for us this year, I believe. I have to stay disciplined. I've got to, you know, and it's not just about staying sober. Like, the alcohol is just a symptom, or a you know, what do you call it? It's the, you know, it's the fix for the symptom.
Yeah, it's not even alcohol is not even the problem. It's just like porn's not the problem. It's
right.
It's the pain behind it is the problem.
Yeah.
And I feel like sometimes it's like, it's an easy scapegoat of not owning our stuff and blaming it on something.
Yeah.
Like, alcohol is not the problem. It's the pain that causes us to need it to survive. That's the problem. And if we can lean into those hard things like you're talking about right now, they're scary and feel overwhelming.
Yeah. And it's
that's not where the freedom comes from. It's on the other side of that wall of fear.
Yeah. And I just want to say, like, for a listener who maybe can relate, like, you know, when you say that pain or that, you know, darkness or whatever, it's not like, I don't use those words lightly. Like, you and me and a lot of other people, we're some tough bastards because
been like, through a lot.
And you've been through a lot, but like I've never had my arm cut off, but, and like, I've had some pretty big physical pain, you know, shattered bones and shit like that. And like, these feelings that I'm talking about, I know you relate with, like, this spiritual and emotional angst is like, I didn't realize the other day how, until I thought about this, is like, I attach so much emotion to everything that I do, everything in my life. And when I do that, it causes me so much pain, like physical pain. And I'm like, and I thought about that. I'm like, I'm a tough son of a bitch. Like, I don't have to be. I don't have to be, but I'm going to go through some of this until I get better at it. But like, we carry some horrible pain inside of us. And no wonder you drank. No wonder you look for an out, you know? But, and that's what I'm trying to get at is like, once you figure out that it's there, and once you figure out why it's there, then we can start chipping away at it and the volume's going to get turned down. Is it ever going to go away? No, because it helps you survive in this world. And it's actually, you know, can work for your benefit, but we've allowed it to take over. And is that your fault? No. Is it your responsibility to do something about it? Absolutely. You know, so here we are. And yeah, does it suck right now? Yeah. I've had some real highs in the last few days. Yeah. Some real good highs. Do I still feel like shit sometimes? Yeah. Is it going to suck tomorrow? Maybe, probably. But am I going to live through this? I have to keep focused on, you know, and it's not the white knuckling. Like people need to understand that white knuckling is not healthy. I mean, you can be alcohol free, which yeah, don't drink. Like if you can just, you know, get through some days without drinking, great. But you have to work on these things inside you that cause you to want to reach for that bottle. You know, you got to work on your spiritual, your emotional, you know, and whether how you do that, you know, thank God I was able to, you know, meet a guy like Ben and he walked me through the program. And am I a champion at that? Absolutely not. I am, you know, I need to work on that myself, but it, at least I'm scraping the surface and I've opened up some stuff that I can work on. And I gotta, you know, just also, once again, I'm going to say my wife is, you know, she's been by my side through all of this stuff and she helps me a lot, you know, but then again, guys, we don't, I just want to say it's not your wife's job to fix you, you know, and I'm really fortunate that she can put that out there and take the time and that she is interested in bettering herself and bettering other people, but that's not her job. And if you lean on them too hard that way, it's going to cause problems. So if you need help and she's not able to do that for you, go find it somewhere else and respect her. Respect her. It's not her job to, you know, to fix you. And I mean, we all want that mommy in our life that's going to grab us around the shoulders and hug you and say it's going to be okay, you know, because I mean, that's just a part of what we all want. But
well, I love, I mean, your story, dude, is incredible. I love this piece here at the end. It's a lot of the guys that I get on here are maybe like 10 or 15 or 20 years down the line, and what to me is like this cool takeaway from your story is like, we're all in process, but you're like a little bit earlier in the process than a lot of people. And like, this is such a sobering conversation of like, you're not sitting here saying, I got it figured out and I made it and I'm on the finish line and my marriage is fully restored and we got a whole bunch of tools now and we know how to communicate effectively. And like, this is all really raw.
Very raw.
And that's what's beautiful about it and why I'm so grateful that you're letting us into your world and your life and coming out of wanting to hide and be an introvert and being so vulnerable in the stage that you're in. It's so hopeful, dude. Like, because none of us ever arrive at this thing, right? It's just like making a bridal horse. Like, you never get there.
Right.
You never get there. But for you to give us a glimpse at the spot in the journey that you're at right now, it's really powerful. I'm really grateful that you let us in. Thank you.
Well, you know, kind of going back to that deal where I step out on stage and that's my safe place, but it's a gift that gives back to me as well. Like I can give a gift. That's, you know, that's what I'm hoping to get from this. You know, I'm a selfish son of a bitch. So that's why I'm doing this is like, yeah, I want to help somebody else, but you know, me talking to you, you know, there's nothing more I desire than to wake up with peace and happiness in my life. And when people ask me, what are your goals? You know, and I know that you can probably relate with this, that, you know, as an alcoholic, you stop maturing. And so I still, you know, feel like I'm a boy in a man's body.
Absolutely.
And so someone asked me, you know, what my goals are, and I've had a really hard time setting a goal, but I know that what I would desire in my life is, whether or not I'm a musician or a horseman or a landowner or whatever, I would love to have peace and happiness in my life. And if I can start there, then the rest of it's attainable, you know?
The rest of it's gravy.
Yeah. So
that's it. I love that, because that's something I talk about often with the men in my circle, is peace. Like, if you have that, like, the other stuff's easy.
Yeah.
It's also kind of this tension of, like, sometimes you have to fight for peace.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make sense, but you know what I'm talking about. Sometimes peace is worth fighting for. And that's what you're doing.
Yeah. And, you know, when you say it like that, it's like, you know, you go back to that little boy that, you know, you didn't stand up and say, this isn't okay, you know? And so you just cower and go along and don't communicate and hide. And, you know, now all of a sudden you're 43 years old and that shit that doesn't bring you peace, you know? And you've got to stand up, and you've got to not be a coward, and you've got to speak up, and you've got to do those tough things. And it's not your fault that that happened and that was instilled in you. So, but it's, you know, now that we're aware of it, we can make a change. And, you know, I would like to say, like, with a lot of enthusiasm, like, I'm looking forward to it, you know, but I don't know. I do look forward to a better life, but I can't look down the road and because I'm not there. I've got to do what I'm doing right now.
Yeah. The work. You're doing the work.
Yeah.
And I just want to encourage you, like why I'm feel so connected to you is because this is the most we've ever talked. This is the best I've ever known you right now.
Yeah.
And like the relatability in our stories is what kind of can bring us together. But I just want to encourage you, like, it does get better. Like, keep freaking going, stay in the fight, like, keep leaning into the hard things, because now, you know, and again, I don't got anything figured out except for this. I know that I am fully capable of doing really hard things.
Mm-hmm.
In my 14 years of sobriety, that I know. The hardest, scariest things, the hardest conversations, cleaning up my messes, choosing humility. I know I can do that. I'm not sure about tomorrow, except for that.
Right.
If I get tomorrow, I know that I can endure. I can press in. I have a rhythm and a trust with God that I never had before through this 14-year journey. So my faith is encouraged. And I know that what I hold things loosely. Emotionally, I have peace. I have peace in my marriage. Hard things come. But over the last 8 years, my wife and I have gotten the tools and the help to work through hard things, and things still come up. And dude, my wife and I can get into hard argument things and triggers that would derail us for 3 or 4 months. And in 10 or 15 minutes, like grown ass adults, we can work through that thing and come out the other side. Like, I can't believe, I say this all the time, like, I can't believe this is my life now. I can't believe of the hell that my wife and I've been through, that I get a rollover when I wake up every morning And she's my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got my back like nobody else. And she believes in me. And she trusts me, which is something that I destroyed a million times.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a long time to get it back. And I know that when I get home, my boys run and jump in my arms. And I'm in process of becoming a dad. That I'm doing right by them. And my wife and I are showing them a marriage that they get to go do, because at some point this conversation needs to be about the next generation
mm-hmm.
and about our grandkids.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Absolutely. And like, dude, the whole world kind of opens up. But when you're in the middle of like kind of where the season you're at, man, I'm just telling you, like, keep going, brother, because it does get better. Some things are always going to be hard, but you get tools and you get your faith gets stronger and you can endure even more than you think you're capable of now. And then you have this peace that other people are attracted to my peace. And I say that humbly, but I had to fight for it.
Yeah.
And now I carry it. And so I just want to leave you with that. Like, keep going, bro. You're so on the right track.
Well, I appreciate it.
You have what it takes. You do.
Well, I appreciate that. And I know that I do. And I've always known that, you know, at some level. It's just that, you know, it's just like, I just want to say, like, thank you for doing what you do, because, I mean, I don't know how many experiences you've had like this, but where, I mean, what are the chances that, like, you know, I don't listen to a lot of podcasts, you know, I don't necessarily like it because it's just banter about this, that, and the other, and I'm just not into it. But your stories, like, I sucked it up like a vacuum, everyone. And, you know, but what are the chances that Cole would move into the yard and, like, I'm in this place where I'm just like wanting to jump off a cliff, and, you know, I can listen to this story about this guy that lives down the road, and
come on,
like,
so, I mean,
I get his phone number, I call him, and like, fast forward, ding, 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 here we are right there in Elko, Nevada, and I'm sitting here talking to you, and I'm actually having some success in my life where, I mean, it's just insane.
I'm always just blown away by God's intentionality. I don't know what else to call it, dude, because mm-hmm. it's crazy to me that I get to sit here with you and hear your stories. And it's like, and I want to thank you for telling me that, because like it helps me. It encourages my faith in this journey of what we're doing with Wild Courage and what my buddies and I are putting our life to and doing in the margins in between jobs and kids and all the things is like, you make it worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you saying that means a whole lot to me. So I appreciate it. And, thank you again, man. I mean, your vulnerability, and I appreciate, and it's not lost on me what it cost you to sit with me tonight and to share some of those things were extremely hard and difficult. And there's so much hope in your process and in your story and where you've been and where you're at and where you're going. And which, again, like we talked before, that's why we're both saying yes to this and doing it. But sincerely, thank you.
Yeah. Well, thanks for
doing it.
Thanks for taking the time. And I just want to say, you know, like when I said, I know that my folks did the very best they could, and if they ever listen to this, which maybe they will or they don't, but I love both of them.
Sure.
And I love my brother, and I have a half sister. I love her. And I just want to say most of all, my wife, for sticking by me. And, you know, I mean, she's like, I, you know, had so much resentment and anger. And I didn't like, I was, this is what I'm getting out of this from with you is like, I kind of knew where it came from, but to meet someone and look them in the eye that can tell me that knows from experience that like, that's going to make a huge difference in my marriage and my life. And I thank you for that. And I think she's going to thank you for that. So I was like, I'm just going to leave it with that. But
well, I hope I get to meet her and give her a hug.
Yeah.
But that's the brotherhood. That's what's cool about this, right? It's like, we're all on the journey. There's dudes ahead of me that reach down and give me a hand up from time to time. And if we get to be in service and do the same, like that's what makes it all work. And just for anyone listening, it's like, you're not alone.
Yeah.
And reach out and take a chance on hope. People need to go check you out on Spotify. That's a good spot to listen to your music and check you out.
Yeah. Any digital platform, yeah. iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, whatever, it's out there.
Yeah. Your music's freaking super good for anybody that's looking for some authentic cowboy, real cowboy music, not the, you know, some of the crap that gets flung at us. You're the real deal all the way around, and you have a gift, and thanks for sharing it with us. And, keep going, brother. You're amazing.
All right. Thanks. You are too, Jeremy. Thanks.
Thanks, guys. Adios.